Welcome back to the Pilots Lounge. On today's episode, we are bringing you Heather Howley of Independent Helicopters. Heather is the CEO, chief pilot, and founder of Independent Helicopters, also known as Independent Heli on social media. And she comes to us with over 8,000 hours of flight experience across multiple airframes, both fixed wing and rotary. She's a CFII, DPE, and has extensive experience in long line work, geological survey work, and a ton of other different types of employment of rotorcraft in the commercial aviation sector. Many of our listeners may know Heather from the reel that did go viral here recently on social media, and we'll play that reel for you here real quick.
Most of the people who would like poo-poo these helicopters are the military who have never flown in a piston helicopter. They have no experience in it, and I could take any of them in here and they probably can't fly it.
So obviously off the bat, the military aviation community as a whole did not receive this reel very well when we shared it on the Broitalion page. So we decided to reach out to Heather and bring her on to the podcast to hear her experiences and her background and her overall reasons that the reel was made and the statement was made. And I think a lot of it was taken out of context. Understand that the reel was obviously highly edited and didn't include the additional conversation pieces outside of just, oh, if you're in the military, you can't fly a piston R-22. But we would like to remind everyone that most of us don't have experience in that type of aircraft, and we have grown very used to the systems in our advanced airframes that help us. So there's a lot of truth to the statement, and I think sometimes it's important that we swallow the humble pill and maybe listen to some of the things that people on the outside have to say. But without further ado, wherever you are listening, grab your cup of coffee, sit back, and thanks again for joining us on the Pilot's Lounge. If you have those items in your cart now through Monday, July 4th, you can go on Broitalion.com and use code INDY20, that is capital I-N-D-Y 20, to save 20% off of whatever apparel item you want to buy. There's some cool new designs, including the Maverick Can't Hover t-shirt, the Broitalion Rotor Development t-shirt in red, white, and blue, as well as all kinds of other cool stuff. Obviously, the code does not apply to the Blue Skies Foundation apparel, but that is code INDY20. Check it out, www.broitalion.com. All right, welcome back to the Pilot's Lounge. Today we are joined by Heather Howley, who is the chief pilot and CEO of Independent Helicopters in New York. Heather, welcome.
Hi, thanks guys. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So Heather comes to us after an interesting sequence of events that made us or brought her to our light. But with her, she comes with a lot of experience. Heather's a CFI, CFII, DPE, has her ATP, over 6,000 hours across multiple airframes, and has a wealth of experience. And we'll dive into her story, what brought her to us, and a little bit about what she's doing. But before we dive into that, we do something on the Pilot's Lounge called Table Talk, where we usually knock out a couple somewhat off the wall questions. I'm not sure what Spencer and Brett have come up with this time, but usually just to get people with their creative juices going and a little bit more comfortable. So Spence is smiling. I think he's got one.
No, I really, usually mine are inappropriate, but are you from New York originally, Heather?
Yeah, I grew up just outside of Albany.
Okay, cool. So I have two for you. I'll start with one and let the other guys go, and maybe we'll come back to the second one. I know most people that have been to New York are familiar with the world famous subway that they have there. What's the craziest subway experience that you've had in Manhattan?
Honestly,
craziest thing you've seen. I don't know, whatever you want to chalk it up to. Really?
No, I mean, my favorite part of the subway is the music. Honestly, like when you go down there and you get people singing, playing whatever, buckets, et cetera. Like that's my favorite. Yeah. But nothing crazy. Yeah. I actually don't ride the subway a whole lot. Where we're located is like an hour and a half north of the city. So yeah. I don't take the hour like this.
My wife and I were up there for a little trip before Christmas and the holidays a couple of years ago. And she actually got really good at using the subway and stuff. When I was up there for school, I never used it. We just walked or took cabs and everything. And so it comes time to head back to the airport, and we get on the wrong line, headed the wrong direction. And I'm like high siding, freaking out, like we're going to miss our flight and all this stuff. And just like super angry. And we get to the stop, the doors open, and this mariachi band comes on, and they just start playing Feliz Navidad and like all these Spanish Christmas. Yeah. It was hysterical. And my wife was like laughing her ass off. And I'm sitting there like trying my hardest to still be upset, you know, and it was fucking hysterical with what was going on. So, yeah, every time I go on the subway, there's always some unique happenings. So anyways, I'll pass it off to Nick or Brett, see what you guys got.
Yeah. I mean, I heard you're on the Hudson there. What's your favorite stop on the, Metro Transit North there?
I think where I live, honestly, you get off in Beacon, come right across the river, and that's where we are. I love the Hudson Valley. It's really cool here. Although going down, you can see Bannerman's Island. Like from Beacon going south, you can see Bannerman's Island and West Point, which is really cool. So, yeah. I got two stops on and off. That's it, though.
That's nice. That's nice. Yeah. I'm familiar with that area. Can't say I enjoyed most of my time there, but yeah, I did enjoy my time on the MTA North headed south into the city. Don't remember a lot of it, but it was better than where I was coming from. So I'll just say that.
Were you guys up here at West Point, or why were you guys both up in New York?
Well, I went to school there on, we don't talk about that. And then Spencer went to, the Merchant Marine Academy. So on Long Island, right?
Okay. Yep.
Yeah.
Well, luckily I didn't spend a lot of time in New York. However, since we're on, on a very linear path here, in all of Manhattan, what is your favorite place to eat? And why?
Oh, man. Okay. So there's a really good place on the Upper West Side called Jacob's Pickles. It is like really, really good Southern food. So they have like biscuits, fried chicken, fried green tomatoes. Yeah. That's the spot. Like that's really, there's a ton of really good places. So, like you go to a food cart and get good falafels. So, I mean, but if I'm going to go, I like Jacob's Pickles.
Yeah. Spencer's writing that down. He's a big pickle guy.
Upper West.
Upper West. Pickles. Amsterdam Avenue.
Sweet. Yeah, food court euros at 2 a.m. are pretty good.
Nothing like some good street food, man. That was my second question, Nick. So,
okay, well then I'll follow up with another question. So, Heather, obviously we're going to dive a lot into your flight experience and your background and your story, but in over 6,000 hours, what is your favorite airframe, I should say, that you have flown, and why?
So it's over 8,000 hours. So I don't know where you got six from, but it's over eight.
Your website says six. Your website says six.
I need to update that. I got a lot going on. But honestly, the most fun I've ever had in a helicopter was in the MD-500. I went down to Heli Expo and they were trying to sell me one. And I was like, yeah, sure. Literally the most fun I've ever had in a helicopter. But between that and maybe an A-Star, but I still like the MD-500. If I won the lottery, I'd go buy one right now. They're great.
That's awesome. I would give a leg to fly MD-500s for just the rest of my life. That'd be great. And honestly, it's funny that you bring up the A-Star, because I honestly didn't really know much about the A-Star's capabilities until the first episode that we did with the guest when Fred North came on, because that was the airframe that he broke the world record in and did all of his stuff in and continues to fly. And it's pretty incredible just what that aircraft can do. And obviously I don't think, Spencer, you might have flown one with TVA, but I've never flown an A-Star.
No, 429s.
Okay.
It's the only thing I have experience on with them. They've got 407s and MDs as well, but I haven't been on them.
That's awesome. We did
some long line stuff, some geological survey out in Pennsylvania in a B3, the AS350 B3, and I loved it. It was really cool. It was an awesome ship. Yeah. Although, I mean, the 429, I fly that with the NYPD when I do their check rides, and that machine, that's incredible. I love flying that. Yeah. They like to put all the autopilot stuff on. I'm like, no, take it all off. I just want to hand fly it because it flies. Yeah.
So kind of talking, you've brought up a lot of good points that I've made note of because there's stuff I want to circle back to, but that actually segues us really well. And just kind of talking about your background and how you came to be doing what you are now up in New York. So what was your initial start in aviation? Was it something that you always wanted to do, something you grew up around, or just kind of found yourself into?
Yeah, so I was a biology major before. I was doing stem cell research out in California and had traveled Europe for like a summer abroad and loved it, loved traveling. I thought I should just become a pilot. And so when I moved to California, I was like, all right, let's see if I can make this happen. And helicopters found me first. So I went for a helicopter ride before an airplane ride, and that was it. First flight, I loved it, and you couldn't keep me out of it. I was like, take all my money. How do I do this? I need to become a pilot. And I looked at joining the military at that point, and it didn't really make a lot of sense for me for what was going on in my life. So I didn't. And then when that company that I ended up working for went bankrupt, I looked at going back into the military again to do it. And they couldn't guarantee me a flight slot. I was like, well, I just spent all this money on flying. Why am I going to waste it now? Like, I want to fly. I don't want to just enlist. So, yeah.
Did you stay out in California for all of your flight training and stuff? Or did you move back to New York and conduct that?
So I did my private and commercial in California, had started my instrument rating, and then moved to Colorado, finished up my instrument CFI and double I in Colorado, which honestly, at the time I hated, but didn't want to do it. But it was the best training I think that I could have gotten because you get the high density altitude and the mountains and it's just absolutely totally different. Yeah.
So kind of looking at your experience in California versus your experience in New York, what was like the big move that kind of pushed you back to the East Coast to want to start your own business and kind of getting into that realm of things, into teaching and doing, you know, the DPE work and all of that kind of back on the East Coast, as opposed to staying in Colorado or California or one of those places?
Yeah. So when I finished up and was looking for a job, I put my resume out. I could literally go anywhere I wanted, and family really brought me back, you know, because my family's all still here in New York. So I came back because of family, worked for a company as a flight instructor. They went bankrupt, then worked for another company. And at the time, I had all these students that I had been working with that, you know, I really cared about. So I thought it'd be great. Why don't I talk to the company that was leasing the helicopter, and I'll partner with the school that I'm currently working with to help out these students from the bankrupt school. And the company I was working with was like, yeah, that sounds great. Give us your resignation letter. We'll totally be your business partner, but you need to be your own separate entity. And I was like, okay. I was 25. I had no clue really what I was doing. And so I did that and then never heard from that company again. So I had leased the helicopter. I had spent $25 on my DBA. That's how it got started. Didn't even have an LLC. Looking back, I'm like so amazed that I didn't ruin so many other things. But yeah, it was just sort of happening because I wanted to help out people. I wanted to help out the students that we had. The business itself just kind of created based on that need. And I have a strong desire to succeed. I really don't like failure. And so I just work really hard, even when shit's hitting the fan and I'm like, I have to, you know, buckle down and do it. So there were probably three times in the first 2 years that I almost lost the business and had to file bankruptcy myself. And I just maxed out credit cards, beg, borrow, steal, you know, whatever I needed to do to get it going. And here we are now 14 years later. So, yeah, I like New York. That's New York's incredible. Always been good to me. I don't want to stay in New York always. I hate the winter, but it's been good to me. So I can't complain.
Absolutely. I'm curious for our listeners who may not know much about you or about Independent Helicopters. Can you talk to us about some of the services you guys offer? Because there's quite a wide range of stuff that you guys do.
Yeah. So more than half the business is flight instruction because that's my roots. That's sort of where I came from. So I continue doing that. Mm-hmm. And then we also have power line and pipeline patrol for our local utility with our long ranger that we have. We do aerial photography. We do charter services under a 135 certificate, special events. I'm sure there's something I'm missing, but yeah, a ton of other things. And really, I did all that stuff because I wanted to do it when I was an instructor. I was like, oh, well, it'd be really cool if I did this too. So why don't I do that? And maybe I'll try this and I'll like that. And it just kept adding to the business. And now it's really cool because I actually let my other flight instructors do it. So they're not just teaching and they're getting more real world experience to make them a better pilot in the long run.
I think that's really awesome because you see a lot of these guys, especially in the fixed wing world, that just are repping out hours and hours and hours with students, but they're not getting a lot of, you know, real world mission type stuff. And I think that that's invaluable. And I think the, you know, you being able to provide your instructors that experience is pretty astonishing.
Yeah. A lot of people kind of comment, you know, how are you still a flight instructor after all this time and all these hours? And I have another guy, Matt, who works for me, who has, you know, probably 3,000-4,000 hours now, and he's been with me for 10 years. And I like the fact that we've got two really experienced instructors here, not only for the students, but also for the instructors, like the new pilots that are coming through that are going to be pushed out in the industry. You have two really amazing mentors that are willing to help and educate and expose you to a lot of the real world stuff.
That's awesome too, especially because, you know, kind of talking a little bit about the military side, right? So a lot of times people, whether they're going to do 20 or not, they'll be like, oh, you know, I'll go get a contracting job, or I'll go fly long line or EMS, or do whatever that is. But the reality is, I don't think they really think through the necessary skill sets and buildup of experience that some of that stuff takes. Just as, you know, we require experience and a buildup of whatever the tasks we are that we're doing, whether that's rappels or fast ropes or slings, whatever it is. Can you talk a little bit about some of the details with like long line work and surveying and some of the ins and outs that you see people struggle with, just to kind of give them an idea of what that looks like? It's not as simple as just going, getting in a helicopter and going and doing something, right?
So the one thing that I've noticed is probably the safety aspect of it, that a lot of people, especially younger pilots, and no offense to anybody, obviously, but a lot of the younger pilots just kind of go in, we're really excited, we want to do the job, we want to do the job well. And so we just kind of push, you know, we're all type A personality, get the job done, and we want to experience it, right? But I think if you take that moment to just slow down and really learn the safety side of it, I think it'll serve the industry a lot better. Ins and outs as far as power line and pipeline stuff, I mean, it's really briefing the flight before you go with your linemen. And take the wires course. I mean, the wires course is awesome. There's so much that the linemen know that we as pilots don't know. And to assume that we know it isn't fair, and to assume that the lineman doesn't know or knows what we know isn't fair either. So just educating each other and having open communication is huge for us in the wire stuff. As far as the long line, I'd probably say it's the same, really. Like having good communication with your crew and understanding what they're thinking, what they're doing, that you may not even realize they think you know. You know, does that make sense? So I think we take for granted what we know, and we're not sharing that knowledge.
So I appreciate that. That's really, I think it's really important too, and kind of plays into some of the things that obviously brought you to us, or that, you know, kind of made us aware of you, and talking about the specific difficulties of, you know, transitioning to whether like general aviation, or even if you're flying commercial aviation on the outside, transitioning over to a different airframe that just doesn't have all the same capabilities or the same mission set as what we're doing right now, which I think kind of goes in to say that we know that, like what you said, was a little bit misinterpreted probably by a lot of people. But again, it's not that you're saying that people are incapable of doing it. It's just a different skill set to fly an R-22 or an R-44 or a 300 or whatever it may be. And I don't think people truly appreciate that, likely because of the level of confidence that we all have to have in what we do right now. But I think a lot of times that likely bleeds over into outside. But regardless of that, I am very curious to hear about some of the experiences you've had with military students that have transitioned out and come to fly with you guys.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I think first and foremost that I need to apologize for the real, if I'm going to say that, because it was by no means meant to be offensive. And, you know, we get comments, negative comments a lot about the Robinsons. And we've trained a lot of military, actually. A lot of students have come through. I've actually done transitions and mil comps, you know, as a DPE. And we've had several students who are really good at it, and several students who actually stopped training because they just couldn't do the airframe. They couldn't fly that helicopter. And that's okay. It's you're good at something else. There's nothing wrong with that. I by no means am I going to say that I can go jump in a Chinook and go fly it, you know, because I don't know the systems and I may not be able to. But I think when you're flying in an R-22 or an R-44, a lot of people have called it raw flying, right? So you're actually hands-on on the seat. There's no systems helping you. It's you're really flying, and it can be challenging. And some guys pick it up really well and some don't, and that's okay. I just really like them. So, but as far as our military goes, you know, we've had, in fact, one of the guys went through all the training with us and then we hired him as a CFI. So he was great. And he's actually doing EMS now. So we've transitioned quite a few guys from civilian or from military to civilian.
That's really cool. And I think it's something interesting that maybe some of the mid-grade to more senior aviators, at least on the Army side, probably have interesting perspective on, is we used to train on a Bell 206 during primary and instruments and stuff. And so you really do get to do that hand type flying, autos to the ground, all that kind of stuff. And the powers that be the past couple of years or whatever have phased those out, and they now fly the UH-72 Lakota. And they, you know, you can't do touchdown autos. You've got FMS, glass cockpits, all that kind of stuff. You're kind of showing these kids, and they're not kids, I mean, they're adults as well, but getting integrated with all these systems and stuff that they may not necessarily really need to know, because they just need to learn how to fly. And I think a lot of us feel that the next generation is sort of being robbed of some of those raw piloting skills. And I think that may feed a lot into perhaps that video that was made and some of the guys that you've seen come out that may not be necessarily capable of flying that because they've never flown anything like that in their lives. And so I think apologies for the video is not necessary. I think, you know, we're all military aviators. A lot of us have large egos. And so people tend to get a little bit of butt hurt if you press the right buttons.
But like, that's how you guys communicate.
It's all in good
true.
Yeah. Like I have to be sarcastic.
We talk a lot of shit.
I get it. We deal with them all the time. And that's kind of the way I've learned to interact with my military guys. And it's fine. Yeah. But
yeah.
Go ahead. Offensive. So I'm sorry.
Oh no, you're fine. We eat our own. It's part of it. If we're not talking shit to each other, it's not a good thing. Everyone knows that. If you're the guy in the unit that no one talks shit to, it's not a good thing. But what I was going to say is, Spencer, you know, you kind of hit the nail there. I flew the 67 in training along with Spencer and Nick, flew the Blackhawk for a while. Now I fly the 72, which is the primary trainer, for the Army. And it is kind of crazy that they're using that as a primary trainer in my eyes, being able to fly it now. You know, for them turning the A trim off is like, you know, raw, and it's just not even, doesn't even compare to flying an ILS in the 206, or, you know, the Robbie in a 206, which was probably the hardest thing I'd ever done in my entire life up to that moment. So yeah, I mean, it's sad to see where the Army is kind of placed, you know, its importance, and it, you know, we don't need to get into all that, but you know, there's a lot of validity to what you said. And I think people need to, you know, take a big gulp. I've flown the Robbie. I have about a 0.7 in it. And you know, I by no means could have gone out there and like tossed me the keys and be like, ugh. It took probably a half an hour to me to kind of get the hang of it. But yeah, super, you know, everyone who flies it, you know, doing autos and doing all the different, maneuvers in that and not climbing with cyclic at all. Yeah, we have a ton of respect for you here, and you know, ultimately we appreciate you to come on.
Yeah.
And also if you're out there talking shit, she's a DPE, she'll flight violate your ass and ramp check you. So
or I can just get you to the civilian side, so you have to be nice to me. Because I can just say no or jack your rate up. So
I would like to actually, so
here, folks.
Yeah, no kidding. So I actually, on the DPE note, you mentioned earlier that you do all of the checks for the NYPD. Mm-hmm. How does that work? So obviously when we go out to do, I know they're standard, like, you know, they're the standard FAA requirements, but for instance, when we do our annual check rides in the military, obviously we have specific mission type of tasks that we also have to accomplish. Do they also have additional tasks that the police department places on them, or are they more or less, hey, go do what the FAA says, and then we'll separately evaluate you on these things?
Yeah. So, well, I do check rides for the New York State Police, New Jersey State Police, and the NYPD now, which is awesome. And the NYPD come obviously with their own helicopters, and I evaluate them based on the FAA. So yes, they may have their own stuff on the side that they're doing. They do incorporate it into the check ride. The last check ride I did was a CFII check ride. And he had to turn on all of his regular equipment that he would do for mission. And he's like, oh, because he's following the checklist, right? Which is what he's supposed to do. So he just turns all that stuff on. And then I sit there and I'm like, oh, that's really cool equipment. Like, and I, being the examiner, I'm like, let me just push some buttons here and see if I can't screw you up to now distract you to get you away from what it is that you should be doing when you should be able to handle all of that. So yes and no, I don't have to evaluate them based on what they know with the MRIPD though. It's just the FAA requirements.
So have you kind of seen, like, what are the biggest trends that you see even with just, I'll say along the pilots? I know on the FAA side, if you go out and fly with pretty much any CFI, I know last year, I think the big thing for fixed wing flying was like practice emergency descents. It was like their big thing all year to make sure people were good to go on understanding how to properly do emergency descents and landings to unimproved surfaces. What has been kind of the biggest thing that you've seen across your evaluations that's probably like the most common things that you find high time, or even I'll say the medium to high time pilots continually doing? Because it's usually not the low time pilots. It's those people who have built the same bad habits as other people.
every check ride that I have done lately, it's the off-airport landing, the confined space landing. So I don't know if it's they're not getting enough experience doing it, or they're just not being trained the right way, or whatever the situation may be. That was one of the reasons why I built this heliport, was because it is a confined slash pinnacle. We're surrounded by a bunch of obstacles, and it forces you to be a better pilot. But I think most of what we do as helicopter pilots is landing off airport, right? We're going to go land to, you know, an EMS pilot's going to go land off scene, pick somebody up. You're going to go do long line. You're going to go pick up a bucket, you know, whatever it is, it's usually an off airport. So for helicopter pilots to not be able to do that at any level, I'm like, sorry, you can't pass a check ride. Like that's a big deal for me. The other thing that I've noticed on the ground side of things when I do the oral exam is NOTAMs, that they're not checking their NOTAMs properly. And it's amazing. Everyone's so reliant on ForeFlight now. They're like, oh yeah, all my NOTAMs are in ForeFlight. I'm like, no, they're not. And here's a few that I found that aren't in ForeFlight. And they're like, what do you mean? I'm like, that's a one location that you can go for NOTAMs, but there's so many other things that you can do. And it'll save you a lot of headache in the long run, because flying through something that you shouldn't be is no fun.
Yeah, no kidding, especially in New York City, where I feel like there's a TFR every other day. Anyway, go ahead, Spence.
Yeah, you mentioned building your own heliport. So I did not know that you did that. I'd like to sort of backtrack a little bit, sort of into the business and entrepreneurial side of you. Can you talk to us a little bit about what that experience was like? I'm sure that there's a shit ton of regulations and stuff that you had to meet in order to get that done. What gave you the idea to do it? I know you talked about having the idea of a confined space and stuff, but what was sort of your clarity moment on, I'm going to build a heliport, here's the reasons why, and what did that process look like from start to finish?
So much like everything has been in my
crazy.
Yeah, everything has been in my helicopter career. It's been, you know, I don't want to say forcing me, but it's kind of like, just here it is, do it. So it wasn't something that I was like, yeah, I'm definitely going to build a heliport right there with all those power lines and, you know, the radar antenna and all the, that was not on my plan. I asked the guys where we were based. I said, hey, I need to renew my lease for my 141 certification. And they're like, yeah, no, you can't do that. I was like, okay. So we had to find a place to live. And this was, we're still within the Delta, but we have our own location and I own it, which is awesome, because anywhere else I was going to have to lease. So we built it really out of necessity. It's really cool though. It's an 8,000 square foot building. We have office and hangar space. I'm sitting in it as we speak. It's really... No, it's served a lot of purposes at this point. We moved into it 2 years ago, and I love it. I wouldn't change it for the world. I think it's so awesome having my own space and really teaching people how to come in and out. A lot of people look at me like, you're crazy for sending solo students out of there. I'm like, yeah, but they can do it. So aren't they getting better training then if they can do it, but they can't do it with you because they're flying on a runway? Like, I don't know. I love it. I think it's great.
I was just going to say, I think there's a lot to be taken from that comment with some of the a lot of the complaints that we have these days is how risk adverse leadership and command can be in certain situations and not enabling guys to go out and learn via experience. And I think that little tidbit that you just put out is solid advice for any of those people that are in those types of positions, making those decisions, is to, you're never going to get good at something unless you're practicing it. So you have to take a little bit of a gamble and trust your guys to go out and do that kind of training. As we were kind of doing our homework on you and stuff, go ahead.
I was gonna say, I think there's a way to do it. You know, you don't have to be unsafe about it. There's procedures that you can put in place that you can expose people to these things, but safely, you know. Sorry, continue.
This is Nick, and then I'll pass the controls back over to you. I saw that you were a graduate of the Goldman Sachs, I think 10,000 small business program. I was curious, maybe for just my own benefit and curiosity, but for some of our listeners, we have, you know, individuals that are potentially transitioning out of the military and stuff that may be interested in, you know, business and entrepreneurship. What exactly is that program? You know, what does the course look like? And, you know, maybe a takeaway or two that you picked up from that.
Yeah, the course really teaches you how to be a small business owner. It was really cool. They cover everything, all your finances, marketing, business plans, whatever it is that you need as a small business. It was really a great program. I can't remember how long it was now because it was a while ago, but you have to basically apply. They have to interview, they accept you, and then you go and you're there in a classroom setting with other entrepreneurs, which is also cool because now you're surrounded by like-minded individuals who are struggling the same struggles that you are. So it was really cool. And if any veteran is out there looking to start a small business, please, for the love of God, become a veteran-owned, like certified business. because you get so many perks doing that. Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah.
No, kind of on a totally different note with that same comment. It is similar to what Spencer brought up about people being very risk averse. I actually had a CFII. He was an older gentleman, and I remember when I was in my fixed wing stuff, I didn't probably mentally myself feel ready, but I just with where I was like, oh yeah, you know, like, I mean, I've got a couple hours, you know, I don't know. I maybe had 4 or 5 hours and, but I had flown fixed wing in the past several years have passed and then went back to do all my stuff. And it had been probably another 5 or 6 hours or so. And he was like, okay, pull up to the hangar. And he's like, I'm getting out. And, I was like, what do you mean you're getting out? Like, I thought he was like going to go use the bathroom or something, come back out. He's like, no, he's like, you're going to go up and do your patterns. And I was like, what? And he's like, look, if I sit in this aircraft any longer with you, you are going to become too used to me being here. And then I'm not going to be able to push you out by yourself. He's like, you're fine. I'm not even on the flight controls with you as it is during these patterns. You know what you're doing. Today's perfect conditions for you to go do it. And there's crash rescue here. If you end up getting hurt, you're going to be okay. And so I was like, you know, I was like, well, that is what it is. And he got his little radio and walked over to the tower, and he went up in the tower because it was a smaller airport. You know, they all knew each other. And so like, okay, well, I taxi myself out there as I'm shaking. I'm sure the ailerons were just sitting there just flapping alongside my hand as I was shaking. But you know, after the first one, I was like, you know, that's to be able to have that knowledge of your students, to be like, if I sit here any longer next to you, you are going to then become too used to me being here, holding your hand and not growing up and being able to do this a little bit on your own, which I think plays into exactly what you said about that of people saying you're crazy. Well, that's true. Maybe there is an aspect to that, but I think it also says a lot to the way that you guys are teaching people, because if you're comfortable enough sending people out and assuming that risk as the instructor to send them out on their solo to and from that location, I think that says just as much about you guys and the quality of instruction as opposed to just the pilots themselves, you know? So I don't know. I have a different opinion of that, because I similarly had an instructor who was like, no, I'm done. Go do it on your own. Because if I sit here any longer, you're not going to get anything out of it. So you need to build that experience. So that's pretty cool. Yeah.
I've definitely had to push the birds out of the nest a couple of times. So,
well, hopefully not in flight, but no, yeah, no. The ejecto cito cuz probably wouldn't hold up too well. Spencer did kind of bring up the Goldman Sachs side of things. Something that I would like to take a little bit to talk about. I know on the Independent Helicopters website, there's a couple different organizations, that are listed, one being Whirly Girls, the other one being the Women in Aviation International, which I know they just had a huge event, I think this year. And I think it was actually here in Nashville. And then the Girls with Wings, which I think is that a business or a foundation? Okay. So that's just a business or both. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about your roles with those and how you're kind of empowering others to go up on the same path as you? Cause I think what you're doing is, I mean, quite honestly, we talked about it. I mean, aviation is a relatively male dominant profession. However, quite obviously it isn't necessarily needing to be that way. And I think there's a lot of changes occurring for the better. So I'd love to hear kind of what you're doing on your end.
Yeah. So, those are just the female organizations that I deal with. But I do a lot more with a lot of different things. I mean, we do a summer camp, we do the disabled American veterans, we do homeless vets, we do got everything, cancer charity. I have, my husband died in 2014. I do a charity for him as well. So those are all the things that I kind of dabble in. The female organizations that I am part of, Whirly Girls, et cetera, I'm a member. And then I do a lot with the Girl Scouts locally and any other homeschool groups or other groups that want to come and visit, and really just exposing the general public and specifically the younger generation to helicopters and aviation in general. So in fact, in August, we're doing World Helicopter Day, where we'll have a bunch of other guys come in with their helicopters. We open it up to the general public. They do simulator rides for free. They get to sit in the helicopters, go for a ride if they want. So it's all of those organizations and all the charities that we play with. It's my goal is really exposure for the people coming to them or involved in them to the world of aviation and specifically helicopters. Because I love what I do. Like, I want more people to do what I do. And little girls, especially, like, you're right. It is a male dominated field and it can be difficult as a woman. Sometimes it is definitely changing. I've got more guys now that are super supportive than not. So I think if we keep on that trend, everyone always asks, like, are women pilots better than male pilots or vice versa? And it does not matter. A pilot is a pilot, good or bad, gender, whatever. It doesn't matter. You're either good or you're not. It doesn't matter anything else. So yeah.
No, 100%. I think interestingly, you know, I have a lot of friends that are obviously females that have looked into aviation, and I'll say, I think the biggest turn away for them, I'm not going to name any organizations or any places or anything, but their biggest turn away typically is going to some of these schools with super, super old school mentality dudes who are a little bit older, and they either creep them out, treat them really poorly, or I'll say talk down to them because they're a woman. And I would say that mentality, I'd say honestly, one of the best organizations I've seen that has done a great job by changing the culture, as much as I do or don't like the school, I don't really care for them too much, but ATP as an organization has done great because they recycle these CFIs, these younger CFIs, and they're keeping the culture of the organization young. And I think that has really helped them change kind of that perspective, at least for people and prospective students coming up through. Whereas again, you have some of these smaller schools and rural areas that those opportunities aren't necessarily as readily there because of the comfort level with a potentially a young female going up against a very old school mentality dude who just doesn't have the same kind of outlook as what I will say modern society does on those things.
I think we have more female students here than any other school in the area. So I don't know if that's because of me or because of the effort that I do, but we definitely have more here than other schools.
I'd like to use the past few minutes of discussion to give you the opportunity to share any advice for perhaps our female listeners that maybe haven't gotten started in aviation. If you have, you know, I don't know, challenge if you've experienced or words of encouragement or advice or whatever for those young ladies, what would you tell them?
So I would say for any student, I have two things. For everybody, it would be do your homework, right? So figure out how long it takes, how much money you're going to need, what resources you need. Start studying on your own before you get into it. Ask questions. It's okay to ask questions, and don't ever be afraid that you're going to offend somebody or, I don't know, you're not going to get the answer. Like, do your homework, period. As a student, do your homework. And that doesn't mean while you're training, but before you even get started. Like, don't waste your time and money if you're not ready to commit to everything that's involved in being a student. And for the ladies out there or the other, you know, minorities that are getting into flying, just do it. Literally just do it. That's the best advice I can give you. Don't let anything stop you. If I had let all the people who said no and that I couldn't do it stop me, then I wouldn't be where I am. So just do it. Don't listen.
Words to live
if you
by.
Want it bad enough, you will figure out a way to make it happen. Yeah.
Now, Heather, do you guys do any work with VA benefits at Independent Helicopters?
So we did, and then COVID hit and we didn't have really a lot of students. And I was like, you know what, the amount of paperwork and the VA is not easy to deal with. Unfortunately, we stopped doing the VA, the GI Bill benefits. We do voc rehab, and I think it's the COOL is what we're now a part of, which is a credentialing.
Army Ignite.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
$4,000 a year.
That's just it. Like, they don't give you guys enough. Like, they're like, here's $13,000. Go get your license, only 1 year. And it's like, that doesn't pay for anything anymore. It really doesn't.
It's like six hours.
Exactly. And then if you're going through without using a university or a college program, they don't pay for the private. So now you're coming up with $20,000-$30,000 out of pocket, you know, to start. And then they're only going to pay you 60% back of like the commercial CFI instrument, et cetera. To me, we were losing more people because they were getting that information and going, well, I don't want to spend that kind of money, you know? And the college that we work with, yes, they can go through there, but that college also has to accept VA benefits then. So we found it was just easier to stick with our college program, get them student funding instead in other ways. And then I have a ton of scholarships and grants that I can connect people with and other organizations that are willing to help. So unfortunately we don't do VA benefits anymore.
Does the New York Guard offer a tuition assistance there? The New York National Guard.
I don't know. I haven't had a conversation with them, but that would be a good question for them. Yeah. I know a couple guys over here.
Yeah. Michigan offers $6,000 for aviation every year. Typically to each service member, it's like a 2-year sign on. So it's not a bad gig. So I wonder, I'm sure they offer something over there. If you ever get a guardsman, I would push them to see if they can get, some type of tuition assistance.
I have one right now. I'll just ask him when I see him next time. Yeah, that's not a bad idea. I always tell people, like, just look for all the things that will help you get through it. I mean, I took out student loans and tried every scholarship I could to fund it. So I get it. It's not cheap.
What is it like building a relationship with the college, the university that you were talking about in order to, is there certain like requirements you have to meet in order to partner with them as part of a degree program, or what does that process look like?
Yeah. So we have to have a 141 certification through the FAA that basically, I don't know if you guys know what a 141 is, but it's basically the FAA saying we've, you know, blessed your course and you can now use it as curriculum. So we had to have that in order to work with the college. And then, depending on what else they want, sometimes it's taxes, sometimes it's just, you know, our syllabus and things like that. And relationships, it's really about who you know still. So you need all those things, but if they don't like you, then they're still not going to work with you. Yeah.
So kind of like on a looking forward for Independent Heli, where do you kind of see, or where I should say, not where you see, but where do you want to grow the business? Are you kind of like kind of on glide path for what you really wanted out of it? Or are you trying to get into any like new zones or areas with the business itself?
So I set a bunch of goals for myself when I first started the business and over the last, you know, few years, and I've hit all of them. So now I'm like, well, now what do I do? You know, what's going to be my next, I call them BHAGs, big, hairy, audacious goals. Like, what's my next really big goal? And I would love to own an airport and add fixed wing training to what we're doing. I think that would be a great addition. And then if I don't do that, or in the meantime, while I'm trying to build that, because things take time, I'd really like to get more into our commercial side of the house, you know, doing more charter, doing more photos, getting more, you know, utility bids, things like that. Because I think that's really what I want to do more of and keep maybe our instructors longer doing stuff like that.
And speaking of that, how many birds do you have in house, and do you do all your maintenance in house?
Yeah. So we have 9 helicopters total. Here at the Stewart location where I'm at, we have 5 right now. And then I have 4 up at our Saratoga location because we have 2 locations. And we did have a mechanic in-house, and we're currently looking for an in-house mechanic. So anybody wants to come work here, I'd love that. But we have a contract mechanic who's up at our Saratoga location that will travel to both locations, and he's awesome. So we do have everything to be a maintenance facility. We just don't have a mechanic.
Kind of on that note, go ahead. I'm sorry, Brett.
No, I was going to say that's incredible. That's a lot of maintenance. You know, it'd be a whole other conversation to try to understand how you work your phase flows and all, you know, working all the, keeping all your birds in a line there, to get ready to go. But I guess my last question with that would be, you know, do you ever plan on upgrading, you know, bringing in something bigger?
I don't think anything bigger. I think if anything, we would do a Jet Ranger, because the utility companies seem to like the Jet Ranger a lot. It fits their budget. It does the job, you know, that's what they want. My favorite is not doing charter. I don't really enjoy that kind of work. So I don't want to get a helicopter bigger to fit that niche, but,
yeah, more utility.
Not really. Yeah. I really enjoy the utility side of the house. So I'd like to do more of that. Yeah.
Awesome.
I don't really know. Oh, there it was. I was like, wow, thanks, Brad. I lost my train of thought. So something you mentioned, you said, you know, you're having kind of an issue getting a mechanic right now. I know the lack of workers, especially post COVID-19, has been tremendous, not just in aviation, but across every profession pretty much. I know kind of in close to my own world here recently, you know, I had a family member put an aircraft into paint, and it's been in paint for over 5 months because they can't even get painters to come in. You know, they say they'd rather stay at home and collect unemployment rather than come to work. And that didn't really, they said it didn't start until after COVID-19 because they quote unquote, you know, lost their job during that. And I know that's affecting not so much pilots. Most pilots, I feel like, innately want to work, like doing something, whether, even if they didn't go back to the airlines, they still want to work. But with that being said, aside from the lack of workers on the maintenance side or the paint side or whatever, outside of the cockpit, what do you kind of see as the leading factors that are really contributing to the overall pilot shortage that we're experiencing across rotary, fixed wing, I know it's kind of a loaded question, but I'm curious to see from your perspective, because for mine, like I know a lot of people from the military went, then COVID happened. They're like, going to go back to the military because that was a safe paycheck. And so I'm kind of curious from an outside perspective, how you see it.
I think it's compounded. You got a lot of things going on that have led to that. I mean, it really trickles down, I think, from the airlines though, if you're just talking pilot shortage. So you've got guys that were aging out, guys that probably took an early retirement to, you know, get the money or whatever it was. It was COVID, right? They're not flying a lot. Might as well take an early retirement. And then there was a gap, I think, in training at some point where people were trying to tell people about the pilot shortage, but we've been talking about a pilot shortage for 10, 15 years now. And now here it is finally. And I think people just got tired of hearing that. So there's that. And I think it's just a trickle down, you know, everybody is suffering from that start. And a lot of us now, to be honest, the mindset that I've heard from a lot of people is like, why am I gonna, you know, work so hard for not that much or to be away from my family so much? I think our view on what's important now has completely changed. And that's totally affecting the rest of the people that would want to work, you know, and not just in pilots, but everywhere.
That's the biggest part. It's the lifestyle. You know, I got three kids. I was looking at doing it. And it's still there, you know, if something happens, but it's like, man, I do not want to be gone 14 days a month. Every month, you know, it's a huge sacrifice to do that. I totally agree. Couldn't agree more.
But on the other hand too, I'm like, well, I'm not married. I don't have three kids. I'm about to go over the dreaded number. And I'm like, I can still get like 35-ish years out of that eventually. But I think, you know, from a pilot standpoint, it's interesting because I have a lot of people in my year group who, I mean, we're all over our obligated time now. Anybody who stayed has either chosen to stay or taken the promotion. And what's really interesting is a lot of them have started within the last year, and a handful of them are at PSA, Envoy, some of those places, and are just seeing the new pay scales come out. But, you know, from my perspective before, when I weighed the option, I was in the same kind of hand, you know, I was the same boat as you, Brett. I was like, you know, if I'm going to be gone for half the month, because I think most only guarantee about 12 days off a month. So you might be gone up a little bit more than half, you know, a little bit more than half the month. But aside from that, I'm like, okay, well, choosing quality of life. Don't really want to live out of a hotel. I don't really want to eat whatever food is available at whatever place I'm at all the time. And of course you can do things to prep and, you know, affect that. But the biggest thing was, I was like, I don't want to go get paid $37,000 or $40,000 a year after I've just been doing this for 10 years. And I don't want to go get paid half in the middle of, you know, and then spend another 10 years having to get back up to what would be a reasonable point where I can actually affect my schedule. Well, now I think they're doing a good job. I mean, at $90 an hour, guaranteed 75 hours, that's what, $81,000 a year. And that's the minimum, not if you take premium flights or anything like that. But again, it's weighing the home versus away. But I think if it continues on that trajectory, they're going to do an okay job at trying to balance that. It makes it appealing for a lot of people, especially when compared to, I'll say, a lot of military pilots transitioning, especially when compared to the amount of time you need in a rotary wing aircraft to go get a civilian job is far more substantial than what you do. And, you know, all that to say, a lot of people can leave the military and be nowhere close to the time requirement to get an EMS job or a long line job, because they're not going to have those 2000 hours for the most part. Maybe some of you did 20 years, but, outside of that, you know, a lot of their only options, if they want to continue flying, are either going to be going to work for a flight school as an instructor or going to the airlines. So it's just interesting to see.
Yeah. There's definitely a gap there, I think, you know, with the transition, that you guys don't come out with enough and you've been dealt, you know, this hand that you've gotten used to, and to have to downgrade, I think, isn't fair for you guys.
Brett, did you have something?
Yeah, I did. first, it's two questions about DPE. So, you know, my first question for you on the DPE side is, what's your pass fill rate, if you'll let me know? And the second question is, how does one become a DPE? Because it seems like it's like you have been chosen to be DPE. Like, how does that like process happen where you just get to show up, charge someone $1,000 cash, you know, fail them, and then come back for $900 in a week? Like, how do you get there?
I wish I could charge those numbers. I don't charge half that. So I'm not going to give you my pass fail rate because I don't know it, to be perfectly honest. I would say that myself as an examiner, I tend to be more understanding. So I try and help people as much as I can without teaching. Obviously, I can't teach you, but if I have asked you a question you don't understand, I try and kind of guide you to it. So my pass fail rate is probably a little unusual compared to the other examiners. But that being said, to be an examiner, when I went through, it was a lot different than it is now. So you had to put in for the National Examiners Board. They have to look at your qualifications, make sure that you are able to become an examiner. Then the FISDO has to have a need for you. So they have to go through whatever applicants they have as an examiner and say, okay, we only need one. So if there's five in line, we take the first one, right? And that's just how it goes. Or you know somebody, right? Then I had to go to Oklahoma. I had to do an online course and pass a written test, then go to Oklahoma, spend 5 days down there, do a practical exam, get recorded, get beat up by the other examiners, do another exam with another examiner, then come back home, do it with a FISDO guy here, giving a check ride to somebody, and then fly with them. So there was a lot involved and a lot of cost involved on my end to become an examiner. Now I think you can do all of it virtually, so it's a lot cheaper, but I think the process is still very similar where you still have to apply and then they tell you whether they need you or not. So
that's interesting. Good to know. I guess my last question would be, are you able to, or is it like a conflict of interest to examine anyone that comes through your schoolhouse?
I get that question a lot. So I am not allowed to do the last 3 hours of prep with them. I can teach them all the way up until that point and then have another instructor do the last 3 hours and sign them off. My personal preference is if I'm doing a private guy, I'll do up until they're solo and then I send them with another instructor to finish up. So they only do 20 hours with them, let's say, and then they'll do the remaining with another guy. Or if they're doing commercial, same thing, like I'll pop in here and there to kind of fix some things, see how they're doing, do their stage checks. But I don't do a lot of training with them because I think it's a conflict of interest. But legally, I don't have to do the last 3 hours. That's it.
But then as far when they come to, you know, take the practical, can they come to you if they don't do that last 3 hours?
Absolutely.
That's pretty awesome to have that in-house. That's got to be.
Yeah. And like you have a relationship then with your examiner, you know, like, you know me, you know my style, you know what I'm looking for. You have such an advantage, I think, having it in-house. And the reason I did it is because we had to travel a minimum of a half an hour anywhere by helicopter to get to an examiner. And I was like, my poor students are paying all this money and then heaven forbid they fail and I have to do it again. I was like, I should just do it here. So that's where it started.
Very smart.
So on the DPE side, are you able to evaluate anything that you are rated in? Is that kind of, it's like a blanket, like you are coming on as an examiner and all the things that you're qualified to instruct in?
Yeah. So I can do private commercial instrument, CFI, II, ATP check rides. I can do them in the A-Star, the Twin Star, the Jet Ranger, Long Ranger, Bell 429, 407. They were actually, the Army guys here were talking about giving me 5 hours in the Lakota so that way I could do their ATP check rides for them. I was like, that'd be sweet.
That would be pretty cool. You should go to Michigan and fail Brett.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be the first time.
just for the sake of it, that'd be pretty funny. So Spencer, did you have something?
No, I'm tapped out. I'm just enjoying listening to this conversation.
Well, I had to start talking a little bit of shit to Brett. So Heather, kind of looking at typically our audience brings in a variety of people. A lot of people who listen are new to aviation or want to get involved in aviation, whether they, you know, want to be a military pilot or they just want to be, they want to learn to fly or they're trying to learn more about it. But kind of the thing that we like to gather from pretty much all of the people who we've ever had on is if you could give like any one piece of advice to somebody wanting to get into aviation, whether that's general aviation or really any for that matter, I think it's all relatively the same. What would your piece of advice be?
I mean, the I had thought going military when I first started, just because it seemed the most financially accessible way to get my licenses and stuff. I think I said it before when we were talking, you know, do your homework, right? So make sure you understand what's involved. I think some people get into flying because they're like, oh, this will look so cool. I'm going to be like this badass helicopter pilot, but they don't understand everything that goes into being a pilot. And there's a lot, you know, it's not just moving. My favorite saying, and this might be rude, but my favorite saying is I can teach a monkey how to move the sticks, but that's not what makes you an aviator. It's all the other things that help you make good decisions that makes you a good aviator. And that's why I go back to do your homework, right? So know what you're getting yourself into. I did not know what I was getting into when I first started. I was like, this is going to be amazing. I love flying. I love traveling. I want to do it. And then I started the book work and I was like, I know nothing. Oh my God, this is so much work. And you're going back to school full time. And if you're not ready to do that, or your life doesn't allow you to have the time to do that, then maybe it's not for you. And if you're able to do both, then more power to you. Like if you want it that bad that you're going to sacrifice here and there to do that, do it. Like I love it so much that I've sacrificed a lot to be where I am. And I wouldn't change it. I love it. So make sure you love it.
Absolutely. And I think that within that, you kind of even brought up a good, bigger point at that too, is everything that we do is up here. It doesn't take a whole lot to have the finite motor skills. It's the decision-making process when things start to go bad that at really the end of the day is going to save your life or the people's lives on the aircraft with you, that you're carrying around. But Spencer, Brett, do you guys have any closing comments?
Yeah, I mean, it's awesome to hear you say all those things, and no one just goes to fly and just starts flying and it's whatever. Like you have to have a passion for it, and if you have a passion for it, you'll make it happen. So we all love it. It's a huge part of our lives, and it's our legacy that we're planning to leave to our children and into the next generation. So thank you so much for coming on and for your, you know, you bring on a huge wealth of experience. Pretty honored to have you. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Like, it's really, I'm glad that I took the opportunity, because when it first went down, I was like, oh God, what did I get myself into? But you guys have been great. So I really appreciate it.
And for all of our listeners, don't poo-poo the R22, even if it's
come and fly it. Like if you're gonna talk smack, like come fly it. Prove me wrong.
She's right.
It might say beta. Beta on the side of it, but it's a difficult.
Beta two
can just be cut off. Just beta. It's fine. No, again, Heather, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun talking to you, and the amount of insight you've provided to our listeners is invaluable. Thank you.
Thank you. And honestly, if you guys need anything, let me know, please. I'm happy to help. So
free flight time. That'd be great.
I can't do that. It's too much money. Yeah. But advice or like a DPE thing. Totally. I'll totally help. Yeah.
Sweet. Cool.
Oh, before we hang up the phone here, Heather, what are some ways that our listeners can get a hold of you, your website, your social media, all that kind of stuff? How can people get a hold of you?
Oh, I'm afraid to get that too.
Well, if you're listening to this, don't use that to spam her or talk shit.
Yeah. If you're listening to this and you're one of if you're one of those people who have been sending hate mail, be bigger than that. Learn how to count. Grow up.
Oh, yeah. But no, so independenthelicopters.com is the website. independenthelicopters@gmail is the email address. The office number, if anybody uses a phone anymore, I think most people email anyway. But yeah, I'm not going to give you the number. You can just email me. Or find me on social. Yeah. It's Independent Heli. Any social, I'm on.
Yep. Again, they'll be tagged on our social media as well for the episode stuff, but be sure to check out Independent Heli. They've got some great reels. You can see some of those reels also on the Brotalion page. They'll be tagged on there, specifically the ones that obviously spawned this conversation, but no, it's been a lot of fun having you on, and I appreciate you being willing to go to the hornet's nest that you swatted to kind of talk a little bit about your story and share with us your experiences.
Thanks. Yeah.